uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful March day. If you are listening on Friday, we are going to rebroadcast this program on Friday due to a speaking engagement I have. So they're, instead of having Bernie Sanders on, you get me. But it should be a good show. In fact, our opening quote, our quote for the day, speaks directly to the law of unintended consequences that George W. Bush may be facing, that we all may be facing, in Iraq and Lebanon. I mean, keep in mind, this stuff hasn't shaken out yet. You'll recall in Algeria, when they were going to have full and free democratic elections, it looked like the radical Islamists were going to win, and they would have, of course, turned the country back into a Taliban-style theocracy. And so that little experiment in democracy got put to an end. And Musharraf is convinced the same thing would happen in Pakistan. There has been concern for some time by Mr. Mubarak in Egypt that that would happen in Egypt. In fact, Egypt is the home of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was the progenitor, the grandfather of Al-Qaeda. But in any case, our quote for the day from John Adams. He wrote it in 1786 in a book he wrote, a three-volume set, in fact, I have sitting right next to me, A Defense of the Constitution of the Government of the United States. And I quote from President John Adams, although at the time he wrote this, he wasn't yet president. If the original and fountain of all power and government is in the people, as undoubtedly it is, then the people have a right, the people have as clear a right to erect a simple monarchy, aristocracy, or democracy, or an equal mixture, or any other mixture of all three, if they judge it for their liberty, happiness, and prosperity, as they have to erect a democracy. Now, you know, back in the 18th century, they talked in rather convoluted terms, but basically, John Adams said, if you really are going to give the people all the power, don't forget, they may choose a monarchy or an aristocracy. They may not be convinced that a democracy is the absolute, well, speaking of which, or even a theocracy. Now, Adams wouldn't have spoken of a theocracy because it just would have been highly inappropriate for a representative from Massachusetts to talk about that, since Massachusetts had for most of its history, as of 1786, been a theocracy. Under a succession of Protestant fundamentalists, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, of course, a strain of that. These were the folks who helped Cromwell, you know, the revolution in England, where for a few years there, what was it, 4 years, 6 years, something like that? I don't remember my British history that well. But for a few years, there was no king of England. And instead, they had this theocracy, essentially, and he was saying, hey, you got to do this, and you can't dance, you can't have music, everybody's got to go to church, blah, blah, blah. And the people got together and said, no, we'd rather have a king, thank you very much. Well, those folks then, those Puritans, felt that they were persecuted in England. And so they came here, specifically to Massachusetts. And in fact, Ben Franklin, who was born in the late 1600s, keep in mind he was in his 80s. In 1787, he must have been born right around 1700. My recollection was that he was born in like 1690 something or other. Maybe it was early 70. Anyhow, that last decade of the 1600s, first decade of the 1700s, Ben Franklin was born. And coincidentally, the last decade of the 1600s was the last, I think it was 1696, was the last year that they had weekly witch hangings in Boston Common. Although it continued to go on in Massachusetts in small communities in small ways, sort of like, you know, when official lynching of African Americans in the South stopped, it continued in small communities for some decades. Anyhow, what would God think of the bankruptcy bill? David Sirota asked this question this morning. And I raised this because the topic came up on this program yesterday, as I recall. Somebody had called in, and I was talking about usury and pointed out, and somebody called in and said, you know, what about usury? And I pointed out that usury is actually biblical, and that in many of the Middle Eastern countries, Saudi Arabia, I believe Qatar, I believe the United Arab Emirates, I'm not certain which of them do and which of them don't, but I know that several of the Middle Eastern countries have banking systems where the banks make all their money on fees because the Quran says it's illegal to charge interest. And so they don't have an interest-based economy like we do. And there's, you know, there's an upside and a downside to that from a business point of view. But anyhow, David Sirota notes, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne writes about how senators are expected to cynically use values language to justify their support of the upcoming bankruptcy bill. This more, by the way, from Frank Luntz and company. We will get into that later in the day. Which makes it harder for consumers to pay off debt, which loosens laws on predatory lending. So David Sirota says, you know, if that's the case, if the Republicans are telling, if the Republican think tanks, if the Republican, great lights are telling their elected representatives, their senators and congressmen and governors and whatnot, that if you're going to push this bankruptcy law, and their syncopats in the media, if you're going to push this bankruptcy law, let's push it in a way that frames it as values. Got to make people stand up on their own two feet. If people incur debt, they have an obligation to repay it. It's a moral thing. Discounting the fact that more than half of all bankruptcies in the United States, and there were over 1.5 million of them last year, more than half of all bankruptcies in the United States were because families were wiped out by medical expenses. Oh, but that's a moral failing, say the Republicans. You should have had a health savings account. What? You didn't manage to save $600,000 so that you could recover from a cancer surgery? Good heavens! So, anyhow, the Republicans are promoting this. You know, let's talk about Social Security in the context of the bankruptcy bill in the context of values. And so it might be useful to go back and look at what the Bible actually says about this. No, I'm not trying to take James Dobson's job here. But it is interesting because it's the Old Testament. The Old Testament is the only place where you find reference to usury, which is lending at high rates. In fact, biblically, usury is interest in general. It's the only place where you find reference to that, just like it's the only place where you find reference to homosexuality. Jesus never said anything about gays. Not one word. In fact, if you look at that picture Leonardo painted, you start wondering about John, who in the Gospels is described as the one that Jesus loved. Not that I'm suggesting that, but in any case, if you go back to the Old Testament, you'll find a few references to homosexuality, and you'll find, interestingly, Leviticus 25, chapter 35. Excuse me, chapter 25, verse 35. If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. Wait a minute. You mean it's against biblical law to make a profit on the poor? I remember when my son, Justin, was a student in Atlanta at a little school in downtown Atlanta called Horizon School, an absolutely marvelous school. And one day, they decided as a class project to make a grocery list. They made a list of everything that, you know, let's prepare, let's come up with some meals, and then let's come up with a list of the things that we would need to make those meals. And so they came up with a shopping list. And then they took the school bus, and this school was in inner city Atlanta. It was within a half a mile of some of the poorest parts of downtown urban Atlanta. And so they hopped on the school bus and they went right into the heart of the poorest area in Atlanta and found a store, a food store, and went in and went through their shopping list and wrote down the prices of everything on the shopping list. And then they got on the school bus and they drove out to the white suburbs and they went to a food store, a supermarket, and they wrote down the price of everything on their shopping list. And I remember that afternoon. Or that evening, we were sitting around the table having dinner, and Justin was just absolutely pumped. He was I had not seen him so passionate, let's say. I was starting to say angry. It wasn't anger, but it was passion. He was like, you wouldn't believe what we found out. Those poor people are absolutely getting screwed. They're paying half again more, in some cases twice as much for the exact same thing, just because they live in a poor neighborhood. Yeah. Well, Leviticus 25 says that's a crime, and God will get you for it. Ezekiel 22:12, if they take bribes to shed blood, you take usury and increase. You have made a profit from your neighbors by extortion and have forgotten me, says the Lord God. Psalms 15:5, he that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent, he that doeth these things shall never be moved. Ezekiel 22:13, if he has exacted usury or taken increase, shall he then live? He shall not live! Exclamation point. Whoa. Everybody in America who makes profits off the poor they should read Ezekiel 22:13. If he has done any of these abominations, he shall surely die. His blood shall be upon him. You get this? Ezekiel, just a minute, we'll finish our Bible course for the day here. This is remarkable. Ezekiel 22:13. If he has exacted usury, that's the one I just read to you. Ezekiel 18:7-9. If he has not oppressed anyone, but has restored to the debtor his pledge, has robbed no one by violence, but has given his bread to the hungry and clothed the naked with clothing, if he has not exacted usury, nor taken any increase, any profit, but has withdrawn his hand from iniquity and executed true judgment between man and man, if he has walked in my statutes and my judgments faithfully, he is just, he shall surely live. Be very careful. One who increases, Proverbs 28:8, one who increases his possessions by usury and extortions gathers it for him who will pity the poor. And it goes on and on. We'll stop at that point, but you get the idea. So, values and the bankruptcy bill. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Limbaugh.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, video joints on every corner, 14 super discount stores, each one bigger than the last, with giant sales blowing out the doors. And I try to be so thrifty, but there's just no use pretending that I understand how I can save my money while I'm spending.
And be careful if you got a few credit cards in your pocket. Welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes, almost 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone high up in the People's Republic of Vermont. Although we've done so from other various places as well. A beautiful day. Our chat room, interesting conversation. What if we had a Bible study class every... I don't think so. I don't think that would go over very well. I may find it interesting, frankly, but I don't think most of our listeners would. We need not go there. By the way, I will be filling in on Tuesday afternoon, the 1st of March, for Randy Rhodes from 3 to 7 p.m. Eastern time, for those of you who are on Sirius Satellite Radio, and we want to listen. I want to get into the Social Security thing and this absolute scam that is going down. And the way that they are pushing this thing and who's going to make out from it. But first, let's take a phone call here. 1-866-889-8894. Our number is Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, Tom. Thank you. And hi, all in the chat room.
There you go.
Hey, I want to visit a topic you had just finished addressing. It occurred to me recently. As a matter of fact, when I heard your show yesterday about this, I was shocked. I have a credit card. I won't say which one. And they offered me a new one, which offered more features and benefits. So I accepted the new one, and they closed out the old one. Well, Tom, I had automatic payments scheduled for that credit card for the past several years. The bill had been due the 26th of the month, and I scheduled for the 21st electronically.
Yeah.
And automatically, so it paid every month at least $400, and sometimes I go in and pay a little more.
Uh-huh.
So I get the new card, and then shortly thereafter I get another bill. This bill is showing, can you believe it, a late charge.
Yes.
I am not kidding you. I was furious. I immediately canceled the card. There's only a few thousand left on it now. I immediately canceled it. And she told me that I should, she said, well, perhaps, sir, you should readjust your payment so that it occurs earlier. I couldn't say anything more because by then I was spitting.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the wonderful world of corporate bureaucracies.
And I'm reading your book, and this is why I called on this point.
Which book?
What Would Jefferson Do?
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to make a bumper sticker, put Jefferson's profile on it, and slap it on the back of my car.
There you go. It's a good one.
It seems to me, Tom, that right now what's happening is I have just felt this and understood it, that somehow in a weird twist of the 14th Amendment, the corporations are asking for protection from us, the consumers. They're becoming the victims, and we the evil ones. We're responsible for the debt. They're not responsible for their marketing.
Right.
I've noticed in the ads, Tom, I'm sorry, I'm ranting a little. I noticed in their ads that what they offer is in big, bold, and they want to explain their features, but terms and conditions are in tiny, dense, and obfuscated text.
Yeah, and here's the other hook or strangeness about this. Back years ago, this was maybe, I was in the advertising industry at the time, so this must have been about 15 years ago or so. They did readership studies, and they discovered that if you put type in all caps, it is harder for people to read because people recognize words based on their shape. And in all caps, the shape of a word is a rectangle. It doesn't have a unique shape. And so words in upper and lower case are easier to read than in all capital letters. And so the mortgage industry, the banking industry, particularly the mortgage industry, immediately suggested legislation that all the dangerous parts of a mortgage contract, that is the parts that really people should know about, should be in all caps.
I was in marketing too, and I was told by the VP of marketing when I was writing up certain documents about requirements of the devices this company was making to put some text at 9 point, track it tightly, and reduce the line space in between each line.
The leading, reduce
I was told specifically to do that.
Yep. It's
because they couldn't guarantee some of the operating parameters and some of the things they were producing.
And we don't want people to read all those nasty little details. Yes, Scott, thanks for the call. Good
to
hear from you. I appreciate it. And I will be in San Diego, by the way, Scott, this weekend, speaking at the Church of Today, following on our Bible study classics. 29 minutes past the hour, telling the truth the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know. I'm Tom Hartman.
A pardon.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, Henry Waxman, Congressman Henry Waxman, Congressman Charlie Rangel, Congressman Sander Levin, Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer, Representative Zobe, Miller, and DeLauro have released a new report that shows how the Social Security Administration has modified its communications strategy to undermine public confidence in Social Security. I got one of these things in the mail yesterday. And in fact, I was going to read a piece of it to you today, and somehow I've lost it. That's how highly I must have thought of it. I don't know. But anyhow, I get a letter from the Social Security Administration. Now, I have to tell you, I have been paying Social Security taxes since 1967. That's when I first went to work, 1967. That's long ago and far away. And this thing gives me a list of all the Social Security, all of my taxable income going all the way back to 1967. And the cover page has this long rant about how Social Security is not going to be able to meet its obligations in 2042. And, it's like, geez, it's like my Social Security first of all, it wasn't until Bush came into office, as I recall. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I am wrong. But I don't think so. I don't think that it was until the last couple of years that the Social Security Administration was bothering to take money out of my Social Security payments, out of my mother-in-law's Social Security income and my parents' Social Security income, take money out of that to pay to send me a statement. I mean, what do I need a statement for? I'm not asking for Social Security. If the day should come that I am asking for Social Security, that I become, God forbid, disabled, or God forbid I die and Louise is going to claim survivor benefits, although she's been in the workplace most of her life too, or much of her life, or God willing, that following on our Bible class here, that I retire at that point in time. I mean, I think it'd be very reasonable for me to call up the Social Security Administration and say, hey, how much money do I get? And how did you calculate that, by the way? But why are they sending me here in my early 50s? Why are they sending me this report? Well, in my opinion, this is George W. Bush illegally propagandizing the United States of America. I mean, the people of the United States, it's against the law. Domestic propaganda is against the law. Spending government money to influence we the people within the United States is a crime. Has been since either 1961 or 63. Every single appropriations bill has had a rider, a sentence put at the very end of it that says, by the way, none of the money in this bill can be used to influence the American people. It's why Voice of America could not be broadcast in the United States, for example. It's why if the Democrats controlled either the House or the Senate, right now they would be holding hearings and investigations and possibly criminally prosecuting Bush and the Bush administration for passing money off to people like Armstrong Williams. There's another one today. Joseph Perkins has resigned. Another conservative columnist. And all of a sudden, he's just decided to resign. Methinks there's more to the story than that. In his column, he says, well, don't, many people will conclude that I'm the victim of a liberal conspiracy. It's like, yeah, right. Well, anyhow, Waxman and Rangel and Levin and Pelosi and the list that I read you, they have produced this report talking about how the administration is illegally hustling us to promote the so-called Social Security reform, these so-called personal accounts, this privatization of Social Security, this scheme. I mean, these folks, the Social Security passed with no Republican votes. The Republicans hated Social Security when it passed back in 1935, right back there in the 30s. And they have hated it ever since. What? Take money from people and give it to other people? That's income redistribution. That's not a good thing. Oh, it's fine if we're talking about giving hundreds of billions of dollars to corporations. That's providing people with incentives to make jobs. That's not welfare. That's not income redistribution. But if some people may benefit from it, that's socialism. We don't want socialism. The fact of the matter is, if you want to use that word, we have socialist police departments, socialist fire departments, socialist public schools. Well, they don't like that either.
We got to get rid of these socialist public schools.
That's what there's.
Socialist public schools, socialist welfare, social security, socialist Medicare, socialist Medicaid.
I'm telling you, they're all in the crosshairs. You want a real crisis. I mean, a serious crisis, a program that really is not going to be able to pay its own bills in the next decade. Take a look at Medicare and Medicaid. Two programs, actually. But I digress. In this report, Waxman et al. Says, and I quote, the agency, this being the Social Security Agency, they looked over 4,000 pages of Social Security Agency documents from 1995, the middle of the Clinton administration, to 2005, right now, 10 years. And concluded that, quote, the agency has systematically altered agency publications, press releases, PowerPoint presentations, website content, and even its annual statements to foster the impression that Social Security is, quote, unsustainable, end quote, must change, end quote, which is essentially what this letter that I got in the mail from the Social Security Administration, I got in the mail yesterday, said. Why are my dollars, my Social Security dollars, being used to hustle me? This is wrong. As Congressman Waxman said, the job of the Social Security Administration is to run the Social Security program, not to provide political cover for President Bush. The agency has sacrificed its independence and abandoned its tradition of nonpartisan administration of Social Security. Representative Sander Levin says, this blatant change in message and tactics is shameless if you can say it, you're a better man than me. Politicization. The Bush administration, he goes on, must stop using the SSA as it tries, Social Security Administration, as it tries to scare up support for privatizing Social Security. The agency must reassert its independence, good luck, and promote its goal. They're very straightforward. Reassert its independence and promote its goal, professional, nonpartisan administration of the Social Security programs. Again, this is not rocket science. This is theft going on. And so now you've got some folks here are going to pay the price for this, maybe. Wouldn't that be nice? Jim McCreary down in Louisiana. It's so great to see Democrats and progressives and just, you know, people who are interested in normal mainstream American values like Social Security. I mean, this to be saying, well, look at this guy. This is the Campaign for America's Future, the liberal group, the conservatives will say, have targeted Congressman Jim McCreary, the Republican from Louisiana. They're running an ad in his home district. It's a hoot. This full-page ad. It says it's got a picture of McCreary with a big smile on his face. It's a very nice picture of him, actually. I would have chosen a little more sinister picture if I was designing the ad. But nonetheless, the headline says, who does this man work for? Not you. And then it goes on. Over the last two elections, Representative James McCreary received campaign donations of nearly $200,000. One-fifth of $1 million from the securities and commercial banking industries. Now he's chairman of the Social Security Subcommittee in Congress, and he's pushing hard to privatize the program. Guess who would benefit the most if that happens? That's right, Wall Street, not Main Street, to the tune of $279 billion. I'm telling you, of all the countries in the world, we have to have the cheapest politicians. Cheap as in least expensive. You know, like somebody goes to a house of ill repute. Where are the cheap ones? Jim McCreary, clearly. I mean, the Wall Street will make $279 billion, and they don't even have to pay 10%, $279 million. They don't even have to pay 1%, $279,000. No, $279 million would be 1%. They don't even have to pay that. It's one-tenth of 1% would be $279 billion. I mean, geez. It's like invest 10 cents, make 100 bucks. If I'm doing my math right. Meanwhile, thousands of Shreveport residents, this ad says, and millions of Americans would find their Social Security benefits slashed Call Representative McCreary's office and remind him that because he's your congressman, he really works for you. If you're told that he doesn't have time to talk with you, it's probably because he's busy with the lobbyists. To learn more about the corruption of Congress, go to ourfuture.org. And then they have his rap sheet, as it were. This is just remarkable. It's just remarkable. University of Chicago economist Alan Goolsbee says the president's privatization plan amounts to the largest windfall gain in American financial history. Well, you put the government in the hands of some thieves. What do you expect? I mean, every business Bush ever had failed. Had to be bailed out by either Osama bin Laden's brother or by his daddy's friends and his family, with the exception of the Texas Rangers, which got bailed out by the citizens of Texas. He has a fine tradition of becoming a multimillionaire on the backs of the taxpayers in private business. Why shouldn't his campaign donors? As University of Chicago economist Austin Goolsbee says, big banks stand to gain nearly $1 trillion from the president's private security accounts, Social Security accounts. In the last election cycle alone, Representative McCreary's contributions from the securities and commercial banking interests increased by 42%, including donations to the American Bankers Association, Bank of America, Wachovia. McCreary supported the president's Social Security Commission report, which advocated the use of private accounts in 2001. 1 year later, he voted for a Republican budget in Washington that committed using $224 billion in surplus Social Security revenue. You notice that? In 2002, Social Security had a surplus of $224.3 billion. You know where that surplus went? George Bush spent it! And the Republicans in the House and Senate. Actually, I suppose technically you could say the Republicans in the House spent it, because spending bills have to originate in the House. Or, I suppose technically you could say George Bush alone spent it, because the spending bills that originate in the House usually are derived from the budget which is prepared by the president. The Senate and all this just kind of goes along. They don't originate spending bills. Between 2000 and 2004, McCreary received $200,000. McCreary's former legislative director, Jonathan Traub, is a registered lobbyist for the Securities Industry Association. Gee, what a surprise. Traub joined Richard Hunt, another McCreary aide, who has also since joined the Securities Industry Association. Oh, I'm shocked. McCreary publicly stated that he regularly visits Kenneth Keyes, the leading GOP tax lobbyist. Keyes was named a major player on the Social Security privatization issue, working for the securities industry. In 2003, McCreary told the press that Keyes visits him every few weeks. Now, if you're a taxpayer in Louisiana, you try doing that. Good luck! McCreary has voted for measures pushed by corporate contributors in the past. In 2000, the healthcare industry contributed $66,209 to McCreary's campaign. In 2004, that figure rose by 65% to $109,000. Similarly, insurance industry contributions rose by 101%. Not surprisingly, McCreary supported the GOP Medicare prescription drug bill, which gave an enormous windfall to the insurance and pharmaceutical industries in 2003. I'm shocked! Actually, I am. I'm horrified. This is not democracy the way the founders thought of it. This was, for more than half of the history of the United States, this would have been considered a high crime. This would have been considered bribery and influencing. And then they note, this is the Campaign for America's Future, McCreary hopes to be a lobbyist someday. Gee, when he grows up, he wants to be. One day after announcing that he would remain in Congress for at least another term, McCreary revealed that he had discussed the idea of forming a lobbying shop. How sweet. Eddie in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Eddie, just a tip, WPTT. I'll be going on the air there on the 14th of March.
Great. Love the show.
Yeah. So what's up, Eddie?
Hey, the form you're talking about, you mean that outlines all the benefits?
Yeah.
If you were just, I've been getting that for a number of years.
Yeah, so I've been getting it for a couple of years, but I don't think I was getting it during the Clinton administration. I think it's just the last two or 3 years.
Yeah, I'm not sure about it. I don't know. I don't think you get it to get older. I haven't not got a cover letter, though, that's trying to scare me yet. I guess I'll have to wait for the next one.
Yeah, well, it's sort of the piece is a foldover piece, and it's sort of like a newsletter, and the front cover is these articles. And then
nice.
You open it up inside, and there's your report. And yeah, it's genuinely scary.
Did you see the CBS News report last night about the group, the swift boat veteran kind of group that's going after AARP now?
Oh, I didn't see it on CBS, but I've been talking about it on the radio here for a week or so.
Oh.
Yeah, they're up to their old tricks.
Well, I don't know if you caught Bill Maher last year whenever he had the after the election and he had the blue states and the red states up there on the map.
Yeah.
Did you see that one?
I did, yeah. And Eddie, I'm sorry we're out of time. It's a great story, but we're out of time, so I gotta move along. But thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the real free speech zone. I'm Tom Hartman, 10 minutes before the hour.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. A little note from Van Morrison there. What amazing music. Anyhow, welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, coming up on 4 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Dan in California on the line. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. I have a question for you. Why was the cap $90,000 instituted?
Well, originally, actually, the cap was like really, really low in the early days. It was like on the first $1,000 of income, and it only started rising after the late 1950s, and it went up to like $1,500, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. And then it started shooting up after the 70s when they realized that the baby boomer generation was coming, and they had to start setting aside a lot of money for that. That's why we have the trust fund right now. It's actually been accumulating an enormous reserve. Repeat your question again.
Well, I guess I understand if they raise the cap.
Oh, why was the cap on there? Okay, yeah. What was if they eliminate the cap, it'll solve the problem. The original rationale for the cap was that because income taxes are progressive, that is, the more money you make, the higher a percentage of tax you pay. That they felt that the Social Security tax, which is a flat tax, should not, if it went, for example, right now it's 12.4%. If the social, or it's, 6.2% that you pay, okay? So let's say if you're 6.2%, if people making millions paid that, they're also paying 35% income tax. And so their tax goes up from 35% to 41.2%. Whereas poor people are only paying the 6%. And if they're making less than poverty, they're not paying any income taxes. And so the idea was, let's not massively hit the really wealthy with this extra tax. Basically, it was a device to protect people who were doing well. And that's still the argument.
So if they raise the amount that beyond the 90,000, does that mean the rich people will get more benefits then also?
No.
No,
it just means that they get the same benefits everybody else does. It just means they pay in. Just like, well, I shouldn't say just like the rich people don't get more benefits from society, because actually they do. They use society's resources far more heavily. By the virtue of their riches, their footprint on this planet is larger. And so you can justify, I suppose, increased income taxes on that basis. But no, that would not happen. And, that's one of the arguments that's made. But I think it should be a flat tax. Everybody should pay the same. Let's just do it. Let's have Bill Gates pay into it, same as everybody else. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I do appreciate it. We've got to wrap up the program here. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Tom Hartman Radio Program. Time to get active, my friends. Get organized. Get political. Wake up. And wake up others.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from Oregon and California to West Virginia and Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, coast to coast, border to border, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live 365's American FM, and on cable systems in 29 states with Cable Radio Network. Does labor have its war paint on? Christor, a member of our chat, our message board, asked the question. He says, I have a lot of friends in labor. I hear a lot of labor stories and news, but I'm curious to know to what extent labor has its fur up with the current political climate. Well, I thought that was a great question, and I do appreciate that being posted, and so we decided to get on an expert on that. Contributing, frequent contributor to The Nation magazine, senior editor of In These Times, David Moberg. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Glad to have you here. Tell us about Andy Stern. It's a name I suspect probably most of our listeners are not all that familiar with, although had this been 30, 40 years ago, his name would have been in the newspaper almost every day. The newspapers just seem not to report on labor issues any longer.
Well, that's true. Andy Stern is the president of the largest and fastest growing union in the AFL-CIO, the main federation. It's the Service Employees International Union. Mainly healthcare workers, building service workers like janitors and security guards, and also public workers. And he's been rattling the cages of organized labor and making proposals for dramatic changes that have upset a lot of people, but also have sparked a discussion that nearly everybody thinks is a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact he's come forward. He's kind of rattling the cage of the AFL-CIO. I mean, there's a bit of a war of philosophy going on within that organization, and it appears that there may be some blood on the floor, as they say, coming out of this meeting that's coming up.
Well, everybody in the labor movement seems to agree on at least two things: that they need to do an even better job on political mobilization. And they've already made great improvements over the last 10 years under John Sweeney's administration,
right,
but obviously not good enough to win the last two presidential elections. But over the same period of time, the union memberships continued to decline, and so there's a lot of discussion about how to do a better job of organizing new union members when they're up against not only very strong employer opposition, but also a very hostile political climate.
Yeah, I mean, isn't really that the bottom line, David Moberg, that the laws have been tinkered with, that the Department of Labor, which was set up to be an advocate for labor, has become an advocate against labor under the Bush administration. I mean, this all started with Reagan when he declared war on organized labor back in 1980. It was the beginning of the end of the middle class in America, the evisceration of the middle class. Here now we see, you know, back in 1980, late 1970s, one person could typically raise a family. Now it takes two paychecks anyway, one person working two jobs in some cases. And this is a political issue that goes, you know, it's not like it's the labor union's fault. It's that, or correct me if I'm wrong, it's that conservatives in government, particularly Republicans, but there's been Democrats who've been in on this just as well. Conservatives in government have consistently been acting in ways that enhance the power of corporations and diminish the power of labor. Is that not the case?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, there have been changes in the economy as well that have made a big difference. And, of course, trends like globalization have been furthered and have been shaped in ways that are hostile to labor by agreements like NAFTA and the World Trade Organization,
right,
because both of those really leave out any attempt to raise global living standards directly and to protect worker rights around the world. And that really ends up hurting workers and labor unions in particular in countries like the United States.
Well, in fact, in many cases, we have agreements with countries where labor unions are illegal or labor unions are only the state union, like China, which has most favored nation status.
Yeah, and so a lot of the debate going on right now is, given how hostile the climate is politically and in terms of employer opposition, is there any way to do a much better job of organizing to, you know, greatly increase the numbers who are being organized? Or is it going to take some kind of political change?
Right.
And those are kind of two poles. Most people fall somewhere in between in terms of the balance of, you know, whether they think it's possible to do a lot of organizing now, like the service employees, who over the last 9 years have organized about 730,000 new members.
Yeah.
So that they've become convinced that it is possible. But some of the manufacturing unions in particular, who are facing perhaps different circumstances, are really skeptical about, even if they work much, much harder, whether they can turn out the numbers dramatically. That every time they try to organize a new manufacturing plant, the employer says, well, join a union and this factory goes off to Mexico or
right.
China or somewhere else.
Right.
And that's a very chilling kind of effect.
So there's a chicken egg problem here, that if they don't increase their numbers, they won't have the political power that they need
right.
to be able to change the laws so that they can increase their numbers. So
yeah, no. It's a very difficult dilemma to be in, and I think that's one reason why they're doing a lot to reach out to other organizations, to church groups, to students, to civil rights groups, and also trying to make the case to the Democratic Party that if they don't wake up to the importance of the organized labor movement to the future of the Democratic Party, it's not just labor that's going to be losing out. It's going to be the Democrats, it's going to be the whole progressive movement. I mean, after all, the labor unions' household constituted a fourth of the electorate in this past election. And that's a sizable group, and they vote proportionally well into the 60%, 65% or more for Democratic candidates. I think... I'm out at Las Vegas right now at the AFL-CIO Executive Council meeting, and Governor Dean, the new chair of the Democratic Party, is here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was speaking last night about how important it was for the Democratic Party, for labor movement, not just to be involved in providing money and manpower, but also to be involved much more in making decisions, and for the Democratic Party to be much more involved in supporting the labor movement. It remains to be seen how much Democrats are going to wake up to that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Republicans are certainly aware of it. They have been noticing for years that one of the financial bases of the Democratic Party has been organized labor, and it's one of the reasons why they've been going after organized labor, to cut off the flow of cash to the Democratic Party.
Well, Grover Norquist, one of the top GOP strategists or conservative movement strategists, has made it clear that that's on the agenda for the next few years, is to try to wipe out the labor movement
altogether.
And, unfortunately, also it appears that the National Labor Relations Board is on the same trajectory, even though they're supposed to be enforcing laws to promote collective bargaining, as the law says.
Right, right.
In fact, they've been making all sorts of decisions that restrict even more who can be in a labor union, and restricting the rights of even non-union workers. And it looks like they may be making it much, much more difficult for workers to organize rather than doing the other thing.
Yeah, and I say that we need to roll back Taft-Hartley, but I mean, there's so much that it would take to get even to that point of discussion. Just this entire system has been stacked against organized labor, and the question that continually I think that we should be asking is, if capital has the right to organize, why shouldn't labor have the right to organize? Or another way to put it, and I think this is a great one, Tom, a listener of ours in Minneapolis, is constantly making this point, is that if George Bush is so in favor of democracy in the United States, we spend a third of our lives in the workplace, what's wrong with democracy in the workplace? And that's what unions are. In fact, in some countries, they refer to them as democratic institutions. As
yes.
You know, it's workplace democracy. It's not called a union. It's called the workplace democracy. And
well, I think this is there's a long history in this country as well of attempts to extend our political democracy or improve our political democracy by extending it to the workplace. And I think one way of looking at the current crisis is not just as a problem for the labor movement or a problem for the Democratic Party or the progressives, it's really a human rights crisis for the United States. Whether freedom of association is really being protected, whether freedom of speech is really being adequately protected in this country.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a matter of concern even for people who may not think of themselves as pro-union in some sense, that you know, that there's a way in which the rights we think that everybody should have are being circumscribed in the United States.
Ultimately, this is just more about the corporate takeover of human rights in the United States. I mean, it's just an extension of a whole mindset that suggests that if it's a corporation, it's fine. If it's we the people, screw them, basically. David Moberg, what can people do about this? What would you suggest? How can people get active in this? People who are not members of unions, which is probably the majority of the listeners.
Well, people who are not members of unions, first of all, there's an interesting new organization that AFL-CIO started up last year called Working America, which is open for a nominal fee, or even if you don't have the money, for no fee at all, become a member of this organization and be in touch with campaigns that are initiated by the labor movement. And it's a way of non-union working people or sympathetic people to become involved in the labor movement at some level.
And a lot of people
find there are things that people can do to their environmental groups, through their church groups.
Well, let's go back to that first group, David. David, let's go back to that first group. How do people find out more about that?
I think if you simply go to the website, the AFL-CIO, there's a link for Working America, and or else they could call. But probably the easiest, if you've got a computer, is just to go to the website and sign up.
AFL-CIO.org. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Okay. And then you were saying.
I'm sorry?
We have about a minute left. And then you were saying there are other options, other ways that people can get involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is just to be supportive of labor issues through other organizations that you may be a part of, and to take part in community labor groups like Jobs with Justice that exist in several dozen major cities around the country. There are a lot of students who've become involved in recent years in, for example, supporting campaigns for decent pay for workers on their college and university campuses. So I think that there are a lot of places just in the backyard, and also talking with candidates for public office, to ask them.
Right, all great starting points. We're talking with David Moberg. David, thank you so much for being with us. David is, in fact, his article in The Nation, Labor Debates Its Future, is an excellent read, a detailed examination of this. David is also the senior editor of In These Times. David, thanks so much. 20
My
minutes
pleasure.
Past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
I guess I better look.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Whatever you want, whatever you need, I will be right here waiting. Baby.
Yes, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by revitalizing democracy in the United States. I'm Tom Hartman. Time for our daily report from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Today we have Victoria Jones with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
Great to hear your voice.
Yeah, here in Washington, all kinds of things going on Capitol Hill. Obviously, the Supreme Court as well. I'm sure you've been talking about that. But on Capitol Hill, we had Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz up before the Senate Budget Committee along with General Pace. And they were there to talk about the defense budget appropriations, supplementals, and to explain why they need the money that they say they need. And if something is a one-time request in a supplemental, does that mean, this is a question, does that mean that next year it'll be a one-time request again? In other words, that it won't be one time? And the answer basically was,
Up is down and down is up and left is right. And Yes, indeed. And the Supreme Court, of course, ruled that juveniles cannot be executed.
That's right. Juveniles cannot be executed. They've drawn a line at the age of 18. It was a 5-4 ruling, with Justice Kennedy being the swing vote, going with the liberal wing of the court. Justice Antonin Scalia, in his dissent, was extremely scathing of his fellow justices and very strident in his language. And I can't quote to you because I'm driving and I haven't seen the full opinion yet. But it is very interesting, particularly as it looks like he may be somebody who President Bush would like to pick for the next Chief Justice.
Yeah,
and with the kind of language that he's used in this particular opinion, he's talked about both the issue and about his fellow justices. Frankly, it doesn't help him very much, but apparently he felt very strongly about that.
Arrogance is a word that Scalia's, you know, describes Scalia quite well. You look it up in the dictionary, and there's a picture of Scalia. he came up here to Vermont and told us that in order for you to have rights, they have to be written into the Constitution, which is the exact opposite, of course, of what the founders had in mind. They said that, in fact, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the Constitution say this, that everybody has the rights, and the Constitution can only limit the powers of government, and in fact the Bill of Rights was not there to give rights; it was to remind us of specific rights. But Scalia doesn't understand that. Scalia and Thomas together, they are both of the opinion that you want rights, pass a law. Is a verbatim quote from Scalia. It's incredible. But anyhow, so we've joined the rest of the world, the rest of the civilized world, in not executing children.
We do. And my first question was, okay, does this mean that there will be changes in laws? Because obviously all those laws are now void. But does this also mean that there may be changes in laws, which means that you can prosecute children as adults when you want to? Because increasingly juveniles are being tried as adults, as you know. And does this impact that? Because one of the things the court was saying in its ruling was talking about the development of the brain. And, you know, how people are just not complete and able to make these informed decisions, and also are very subject to other outside influences at these younger years.
Right. And it's one of the reasons why we have child labor laws, why we have alcohol laws, why we have driver's license ages. You know, it's just...
should go up anyway.
Yeah, this is not rocket science. This is good, you know, intuitional stuff that human beings have known since tribal days, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years. Well, we've got about a minute left. Anything else happening in Washington?
Yes. Senate Armed Services Committee, Generals Jones, Abizaid, and Brown, basically at the head of the world for the U.S. military. They were testifying. Interesting testimony, basically saying that intelligence is not improving very much in Iraq. Senator Warner expressing his and Senator Levin's concern that the Iraqi government is not forming itself fast enough, also saying that he did not see a timeline for withdrawal, and also saying that Syria really shouldn't be getting any kudos for handing over Saddam Hussein's brother. They should have done it a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, perhaps they should have, but still, it so much reminds me of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. You know, it's just this whole... Oh, my. Anyway, Victoria, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. Thanks so much for the report. From the Talk Radio News Service, Victoria Jones in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Hartman. You're in the real free speech zone. Yes, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire here. 29 minutes past the hour.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, "We eliminate the middleman"?
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
And now they want to cut off our Social Security. Or, you know, hand it over to their buddies on Wall Street. Well, that's the Bush solution. Just die before you get old. Welcome back. Yeah, just fade away. See this? These old songs are just full of George W. Bush solutions to the Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security problems. It's just no problem. U.S. worker satisfaction decreasing, survey says. Did you see this in the paper today? Associated Press reports. Adam Geller wrote this article. U.S. workers pushed to produce more and uneasy about new technology and other changes are markedly less satisfied with their jobs than a decade ago, a new survey says. Well, gee, let's see. Halfway into the eight-year Bush administration, people are much less happy with their jobs than they were halfway through the Clinton administration. Why might that be? Might it be because the Bush administration is hostile to workers? Might be. Half of U.S. workers are happy with their jobs, down from nearly 59% in 1995. Says this study, compared to a decade ago, job satisfaction has declined among all types of workers. The biggest decline in on-the-job happiness was among workers earning $25,000 to $35,000 and among workers between the ages of 35 and 44. The workers most satisfied with their jobs, those who earn $50,000 or more. Gee, what a surprise. They go on to say workers voice substantial discontent with their company's bonus plans, promotional policies, health plans, and pension benefits. Only about one in three said they were satisfied with their pay. That one in three had to be CEOs, right? Who's ever satisfied with their pay? Maybe some folks are. I don't know. I suppose it's possible. It's possible. Uh-oh. Time for a Bush Greenwatch alert. This from bushgreenwatch.org. Yes, indeed. George Bush plans further cuts in forest protections. Next Monday, the final day. Get ready. It's coming. Next Monday marks the final day for public comment on a proposed new Bush administration rule that will restrict public input and environmental review of forest management plans under the National Forest Management Act, otherwise known as NFMA. It will also rescind wildlife protections that were established decades ago under, of all people, President Reagan. Under the Bush administration's proposal, Reagan was too much of a wimp for George W. It's just, what? He's going to protect endangered species? Are you kidding? We can't have that. Under the Bush administration's proposed forest plan rules, it would no longer be necessary to complete an environmental impact statement. This is a basic requirement of the National Environmental Policy Act. We don't need no stinking environmental impact statements. You just put your oil well over there, Ralph. Environmental impact statements. I don't think we need those. No, siree, Bob. Hey, get them out of the way here. Environmental impact statements ensure that forest decisions are based on the best available science. Science? We don't need no stinking science. By removing this step, an important tool for forest managers to evaluate plans for potential harm to water, wildlife, old growth, and roadless areas is eliminated. Ta-ta-da! Eliminated. We don't need no stinking protections. The water, wildlife, old growth, forests, and roadless areas. You kidding? We don't need none of that. Wildlife viability requirements will be negated, meaning that viable levels of native fish and wildlife populations will no longer need to be maintained. We don't need anything living around here. After all, the rapture's coming, to quote James Watt. When he was Reagan's Interior Secretary and they asked him why he was willing to sell off wilderness lands for pennies on the dollar to corporate contributors to the Reagan campaign, who would then go in and rape the land, open pit mining, strip mining, and James Watt said, Jesus is going to return and make all things new. We need not go there. Anyway, viability requirements are going to be negated. The Forest Service will also be relieved of duties to monitor wildlife populations. It's called the Three Monkeys Technique. Hear no evil. Speak no evil. See no evil. If you don't know that the wildlife populations are crashing, you know, it's like that ancient but thought-provoking question that Carolyn Kay of Make Them Accountable signs all her letters or emails with. If a Bush family member commits a crime and no one hears about it, has a crime been committed? Instead of monitoring wildlife populations, forest plans need only a, quote, framework to provide the characteristics of ecosystem diversity in the plan area, end quote. In other words, all you have to say is, here's how it ought to be. And that's enough. You don't have to say, oh, here's how it is, or here's what's going on, or here's what we're doing. Just here's how it ought to be. Disclosure and even studying cumulative impacts of management activities across the national forest will be unnecessary under the new regulations. The proposed changes also ignore the role of science in the decision-making process. Under the new rules, agency officials are actually given the discretion to ignore scientific evidence and recommendations. I'm telling you, it really and truly is the three monkeys strategy. It should be the new motto of the Bush administration. Hear no evil, see no evil. And if anybody speaks evil, out their wives. In reference to Joe Wilson there, of course. Environmentalists point out that back to BushGreenwatch.org. Environmentalists point out the lack of reliable public information regarding environmental consequences of forest plans, combined with increased discretionary power over the level of scientific involvement in forest planning, will mean an open door for, guess who? Corporate incursions into timber, mining, and oil resources in our national forests. As Randy Spivak, executive director of the Americans Land Alliance, told Bush Greenwatch, this is yet another example of the Bush administration putting industry profits ahead of the interests of Americans. Spivak continued, the new rules reject science and demonstrate blatant disregard for public input. Americans care deeply about these places where they hike, fish, and relax and want to protect these places for future generations. With Bush's allegiance to the timber, oil, and gas industries, however, what is now a forest heritage could soon be history. Our Bush Greenwatch alert for the day. Yeah, enough of that. Okay, after big payout, personal, back to the state of the middle class. You'll recall the story before the last story was about how some 56% of people say that they are dissatisfied with their jobs, a dramatic increase since the Clinton presidency.
Surprise, surprise.
Well, U.S. personal income, this is from today's Wall Street Journal. Article by Gintautas Dimsius. U.S. personal income fell 2.3% in January from a month earlier. Its sharpest decline in 11 years. Gulp. The Commerce Department said personal income decreased by $238.6 billion. To $9.966 trillion in January. It's a 2.3% decline, reflecting a slump in auto sales. Now, but the economy's doing just great. All you have to do is ask any CEO, ask any multimillionaire commentator on television, the economy's doing just great. Unless you make under $100,000 a year. Or unless you make under $50,000, then you got a bit of a problem. Reflecting a slump in auto sales, consumer spending fell slightly. Well, gee, you don't have the income. How are you going to spend it? Although it's interesting, income fell 2.6%, 2.3%. Spending fell only 0.2% after adjustment for inflation. Why? Because people have credit cards and homes they can borrow against. Spending on durable goods or products expected to last more than 3 years fell 4.3% in January. Uh-oh. This is the big stuff that we still have factories to make. Wage and salary growth not eased. Don't you just love this? And it's not just the Wall Street Journal. I guarantee you, every publication in America, this is probably the language they're going to use on the news tonight if they decide to talk about it. It'll be interesting to see. I suspect that the corporate media will choose not to discuss this. They typically don't. It has to do with salaries, wages, working people. It doesn't get discussed. If it has to do with the stock market, most of which is, you know, the vast majority of stocks in this country held by the top 10% of wage earners has to do with the stock market, then it's big news. Well, because all those guys on TV are heavily invested in the stock market. They want to know what's going on. But worker salaries, not a big deal. Anyhow, wage and salary growth eased, rising $22.3 billion, or 0.6%. That includes, you know, CEOs and everybody else. Disposable personal income fell 2.6%, or $241.1 billion. About what we spent in Iraq last year. Demand for new single-family homes fell 9.2% in January. This is a concern. They say sales decreased nearly everywhere except the West. Talking about home sales. This is the beginning of a bursting bubble, I'm telling you. It's not a good time to be maxed out on a mortgage. Or to be buying a house, because odds are that 6 months or a year from now, it's going to be worth a little less than it is now. In fact, Reuters reports, this is an article by Kristen Roberts, income rises, core inflation picks up. Now, or income falls, core inflation picks up. This is the deadly mixture. You have falling personal wages and rising costs, inflation. And what do you have? You have more corporate profits. You have a reduction in the problems of a government that's in debt because they can pay off their debts with dollars that are worth less. Inflation decreases the value of the dollar. But you have the middle class being absolutely squeezed. This Reuters story, a sharper than expected pickup in inflation sparked fears the Federal Reserve may raise interest rates faster than expected. We want to point out the price index for consumer spending, a measure of inflation, gained 0.2% in January and rose 0.3% when volatile food and energy prices were stripped out. That's a sharp pickup from December's flat readings. They marked the biggest monthly prices in, increase in core prices since October of 2001. And they go on to point out the Fed has raised rates 6 times since last June to head off inflation concerns. Well, actually, I'll tell you the reason why the Fed has raised rates 6 times is because Alan Greenspan, in a hysterical effort to get George W. Bush reelected, cranked interest rates down to the point where they were actually negative. When you compared the lowest interest rates with the rate of inflation, there were some months in there where if you borrowed money and just sat on it and then paid it back, even though you paid interest on it, you would have made out because inflation ate up more of the, well, only the banks could do this. But in any case, the bottom line is that Greenspan took us into negative inflation, negative interest rate territory, which, of course, created the housing bubble. But it was the only way that he could hold the economy together so that the clear and obvious consequences of trickle-down economics wouldn't be visible to everybody in time for the 2004 election. And so they've got to take it back to normal. I mean, they're not even back to normal yet. The Fed has raised rates 6 times since last June to head off inflation concerns and has said it should be able to continue to increase borrowing costs at a, quote, measured pace. Notes Kristen Roberts in this Reuters article. And finally, how much money are people saving since their wages are going down and inflation is driving costs up and corporate profits, of course, are increasing? The personal savings rate was 1% in January, indicating that Americans were setting aside 1 penny from each dollar earned. That was down from 3.6% in December. Why might that be? Well, because things are just getting a little worse. And then you look at the president's proposed fiscal budget for 2006. This is really scary. Again, this is the kind of stuff, why isn't this in the newspapers? You would think every newspaper in America, this came out a couple of weeks ago, and it's like nobody's reporting on this. Comprehensive school reform, 2005, $205 million, 2006, zero. Perkins loans programs, high school programs, $2.17 billion, this year, zero. Perkins loans program, these are loans for college students, $66 million last year, zero this year. By this year, I mean 2006. This coming fiscal year, it actually starts in October. Safe and drug-free schools, state grants, Yes, this administration is opposed to drugs in schools. In fact, in 2005, they spent $437 million to help encourage students not to use drugs and help students who are addicted to drugs, you know, kick it, solve their problem. How much will it be in the 2006 budget?
Yeah, they're on their own.
Zero. Small elementary and secondary education programs. This is for small and rural schools. Last year, $304 million. This coming year, starting in October, zero. How about energy? Hydropower program. Last year, they spent $5 million. That's nothing like the $9 billion that Dick Cheney wants to give to his buddies in the oil industry. This year, zero. And on it goes. It's amazing. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I'm on the law and a low one. I'm on the law and a low one.
Well, actually, in the case of George W. Bush, it's not quite like that. He fought the law and he won. Yes, indeed. He, you know, busted for cocaine. He did well. Actually, the law won. He had to do a month's community service, and then he was able to get it pulled off his records when he became governor. And busted for drunk driving. He was able to hide that until it came out just before the 2000 election. And on it goes, anyway. Community service programs, health and human service. We were talking about the cuts in the Bush administration budget, the 2006 budget. And nobody's talking about this stuff. It's like, you know, the entire media machine. It's like, well, let's just kind of ignore that. You know, Michael Jackson's trial is far more exciting. And of course, there is an element of that to it, that media has become circus in the bread and circus of America. You know, the old bread and circus thing, the old Roman theory. As long as people had enough bread and you provide them with a circus, you could do pretty much whatever you wanted. You have a dictatorship. Nero's great theory of governance. Anyhow, community service programs, this is from Health and Human Services budget, from $30 million in fiscal 2005. Fiscal 2006 request, zero. Early Learning Opportunities Program, $35 million, when it became zero. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, $60 million, became zero. Now, we are facing a bird flu pandemic. An epidemic that could kill 100 million people, according to the World Health Organization. And George Bush looks at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and says, whack $60 million out of their budget. And to make it even better, let's take their Preventative Health and Health Services Block grants of the CDC, $131 million this year, make that zero, too. And let's do their youth media campaign, because it's talking to people about sexually transmitted diseases, let's take that from $59 million to zero. And emergency medical services for children? We spent $20 million on it last year. Let's make that one zero. And how about health facilities construction to help build hospitals? And we'll let Bill Frist do that. Take it from $476 million to zero. How about health community access programs in poor communities? Take it from $82 million to zero. Trauma care? Zero. Traumatic brain injury? Zero. And on it goes. But at some point, Americans are going to wake up, look around, and say, oh, my God, I had no idea. How did these people do this in my name? Hopefully, we will all be able to wake them up before that day comes.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be...
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from Oregon to West Virginia, California to Pennsylvania. Well, whatever. Streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, covering not only the United States, but Canada and part of Mexico as well. Beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live365's American FM. If you want to drop into our chat room, presided over in extraordinary fashion by Sue in England, actually, it's go to tomhartman.com and you just click chat room. It'll get you in there. If you'd like to call, our number is 1-866-889-8894, although if you're listening to the program on Friday, this is a repeat. And first, they came for the terrorists. What's next? Who's next? You? Me? What is our government up to? What have they been doing in our name? Fiona Doherty is a senior associate in the U.S. Law and Security Program for Human Rights First, which is formerly known as the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. And Fiona is with us today. And Fiona, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, I'm very pleased to have you here. You folks, this being the formerly the Lawyers Committee, now it's Human Rights First, and the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, just filed a lawsuit. And tell us about this.
Well, as you said, we just filed the lawsuit, and we filed it this morning against Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in federal district court on behalf of 8 plaintiffs, 4 from Afghanistan and 4 from Iraq, each of whom suffered serious abuse while in U.S. custody. And the allegations by our clients are specific and detailed. They include death threats and mock executions, severe and repeated beatings, sexual humiliation and assault, forcible sleep deprivation, deprivation of food and water, and restraint in contorted in very painful positions. And each of our clients was released from U.S. custody after months of detention without being prosecuted for any wrongdoing and without receiving redress for any of their injuries. I should also mention that Human Rights First and the ACLU are bringing this suit, but we are joined as counsel on that suit by Rear Admiral John Hudson, one of the top formerly military lawyers. He was Judge Advocate General of the Navy. Another high-level military lawyer who's joined us on the suit is Brigadier General James Cullen. He was the former Chief Judge of the U.S. Army Court of Criminal Appeals. We also have Bill Lon Lee on the suit as counsel. He was a former Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice.
That's remarkable. So these are all folks who, if I think one can assume that given the fact that we're willing to torture people to get confessions out of them, and it certainly sounds to me like everything you described fits the definition, the classic definition, any dictionary definition, and certainly the Geneva Convention's definitions of torture. If we're willing to torture people to get evidence that they've committed a crime, at least by the most brutal standards that one could apply, we can be pretty sure that these people had not committed any crimes. Or the government would be prosecuting them, would they not?
That's exactly right. There is no allegation from the government that any of these individuals were involved in criminal activity. As I said, they were all released without charge or with any attempt at prosecution for wrongdoing. And what we're doing through this suit is we're asking the courts to find that Secretary Rumsfeld violated the U.S. Constitution as well as international laws that clearly prohibit torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, such as the Geneva Conventions, which you mentioned, but also the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has also signed and ratified. And under law, a commander like Secretary Rumsfeld is legally responsible for unlawful conduct, which he directly ordered, as well as for unlawful conduct which was committed by his subordinates, which he knew about or should have known about, but he failed to take corrective action.
Yeah. Now, let me just share with our listeners a couple of these stories. Ollie H. is one of your clients.
Yes.
He's going by a sort of Jane Doe type of pseudonym here because he fears for his life.
Yes, he's the only one of our clients. Yes.
Yeah, he was an Iraqi high school student. He was 17 years old when he was detained by U.S. military in August of 2003. Soldiers shot him in the neck and back and threw him to the ground before arresting him. Military personnel refused to provide military care for Ali for hours after his arrest, even though he was bleeding profusely from 2 gunshot wounds. The bullets were eventually removed from his neck and back in a brutal fashion and without anesthetic. Is this serious?
These are the allegations. We worked very closely in identifying our clients with human rights and humanitarian organizations in Afghanistan and Iraq to identify individuals who had come forward and said that they had been abused in U.S. custody.
Yeah.
We traveled to Afghanistan and to Jordan to interview those individuals, and many of them still had the paperwork confirming their detention. A few still bore the physical signs of the abuse that they'd suffered in U.S. custody, and we worked very hard over the last few months to compare the allegations that they had put forward with publicly reported information. And, you know, in the last year, a flood of information has come out with other people alleging very, very, very similar things.
Yeah. It continues. He was then denied food, water, and pain medication after he was shot. He received a life-threatening shrapnel wound during a mortar attack. We refused to provide him with adequate medical care. Now, if there was a mortar attack and he was shot, is it reasonable to assume that Ali was a combatant? Was he fighting against us, or was he just some guy who got caught? I mean, how did he get into this situation?
Well, I mean, he says he was detained by mistake. And the mortar attack, what that was actually while he was being held at Abu Ghraib. Because there weren't proper facilities to hold people, they held them in outdoor tents within the facility. And when Abu Ghraib suffered, he was severely injured in that attack. And he was given medical care for that. He was given surgery in his abdomen, but he still suffers incredible pain from that.
Yeah, it says, while recovering from abdominal surgery, military personnel intentionally inflicted further pain and torture on Ali. He was dragged roughly from one location to another, kept shackled hand and foot to a bed with a blanket placed over his face. They cut off his identification bracelet, confiscated his release papers, and physically threw him from a bus to the ground outside while he still had an IV tube in his arm?
Yes, it's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying what happened to these people.
And
under our watch.
Under our watch. And And the U.S. government is defending this. They're going to go into court and say this is all just fine with us.
Well, we don't know yet what the U.S. government will say. And, of course, the suit is against Rumsfeld himself, so it will be his lawyers who come to court.
Yeah.
But we assume that he will be defending the suit.
Yeah, we're speaking with Fiona Doherty of Human Rights First. Fiona, we have a caller. John in Shreveport, Louisiana, is on the line. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, by the way. John, what's up?
I'm sorry to hear all this, but it reminds me of what the U.S. Army did when they came down here 140 years ago and did the same thing to us, essentially.
So you're suggesting we haven't learned any lessons in 140 years?
No, we haven't
years?
Learned. No, the U.S. government's learned. Now, see, Tom, here's where you and I have agreements. I hate to say that, but the U.S. government is still. Its power is more concerned about anything else.
Yeah.
But I would like to ask your guest, does she think the U.S. has the right to tell the Iranians whether or not they should have nuclear weapons?
Well, thanks, John, for the call, but I suspect, Fiona, that you're not into nuclear weapons. Oh, Fiona, what happened? Did we lose Fiona?
Hello?
Hey.
I am back.
I'm sorry. I lost you. I had the wrong
no
button
problem.
Pushed. And we just took a caller, I guess, from a call from a caller. You're the guest. And he was asking about whether you had a position on nuclear weapons in Iraq, which I suspect is not your issue.
It's not our issue at all. Again, this suit is really about seeking accountability for the torture and other abuses inflicted upon detainees in Iraq, and also to ensure that those abuses are stopped.
Yeah. So here we have Mohammed Karim Shirullah. He was beat so fiercely that the blows ruptured his right eardrum. He was never treated after the beating. He's deaf in his right ear. He was subject to extreme sensory deprivation, isolation, forced to wear black opaque goggles, wrist restraints for more than 2 weeks. Soldiers stripped him naked, probed his anus, and photographed him. They also stripped him naked and threw water on him during interrogations. He was forced to use an open toilet with knowledge that such treatment would cause psychological suffering by Afghan. This was in Afghanistan.
It's in Afghanistan. He's one of our Afghan clients. He's a 45-year-old Afghan citizen. As I said, there are four clients from Afghanistan and four from Iraq.
Which raises the question, how did he get caught or how did he get dragged into this?
Well, again, he says he was absolutely taken by mistake, and he was released without any charge whatsoever. And this is not at all unusual. The ICRC and the U.S. military have acknowledged that between 70 and 90% of people were lifted or are lifted by mistake. I mean, and because there's no adequate review procedure, they're kept in for a long time without being released.
So this is nothing
out of the ordinary at all.
So our government tells us that 70 to 90% of the people in, for example, the concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay are there by mistake?
Well, not necessarily at Guantanamo, although there are many, many, many allegations that people were brought to Guantanamo by mistake. You probably know that the U.S. government offered bounties for the
right.
capture of Taliban members.
Right. And so, if you didn't like your next door neighbor, you just drag Ralph in by the collar and say, "Here, here he is."
Right. Exactly. And there, you know, many of our clients, especially the Afghan clients, say that they were arrested on a tip from a jealous neighbor who might have wanted their land or something like that, which is not at all an uncommon story in Afghanistan.
Sure.
An internal military report cites estimate that between 85 and 90% of detainees at Abu Ghraib were of no intelligence value. So the same is really true in Iraq.
85 to 90%
of detainees at Abu Ghraib.
To what extent are, thousands and thousands of people have gone through have been detained by U.S. military and in these prisons in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then released back into the general population, presumably, when it's been determined that they were caught by accident or that they got dragged into this. To what kind of impact is this having on the perception of the average Iraqi of the United States?
Well, I think it's having a serious impact, and that's one of the reasons that we're bringing the suit. For almost a year now, even before the Abu Ghraib pictures were released, we've been engaging with members of the administration and Congress urging public reform of U.S. interrogation practices so that people abroad will understand that the U.S. is really not about this. And, of course, both Secretary Rumsfeld and President Bush have said that, but their actions haven't followed their words. And this lawsuit is really, we come to it reluctantly. It's the last resort to try to make sure that the world receives a clear message that this is not acceptable in U.S. democracy.
So,
in the last year, it's really the courts who've been taking an active role in holding the executive to account.
Yeah. And so when George Bush says to Vladimir Putin at the press conference, we have an open society, we respect human rights, you're saying to him, or essentially to Don Rumsfeld specifically, but to the Bush administration, sounds good, let's actually do it.
Right, that's exactly right, and that's what our open society allows. And when the framers of our Constitution engineered the system of checks and balances upon which our democracy depends, the courts specifically were intended to
the authority for this. Yeah.
Exactly.
To cover this. We've been talking with Fiona Doherty. Thank you so much for being with us, Fiona. What's the website for Human Rights First?
It's www.humanrightsfirst.org. All one word.
There you go. And the ACLU, of course, is aclu.org.
Yes.
Good work. Keep it up. Thanks,
okay,
thanks
thank
for being
you.
With us today. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. You're in the Democracy Zone.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, yes. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. The White House must charge or free Jose Padilla. People for a couple of years have been pronouncing it Padilla. Why have they been mispronouncing his name? Because he wasn't allowed to talk to anybody to tell him how to pronounce his name. Amazing. So for 2.5 years, can you imagine? I remember the news reports 2.5 years ago when this guy was arrested. What they had based their arrest of him on was that he had visited websites that described how to make a dirty bomb. So can you imagine that Attorney General Gonzalez, or Ashcroft in this case, but now it's Gonzalez, can you imagine that he notices that you've been looking at some dirty bomb websites apparently not something they want to encourage, if there's any left. And they show up at your house, drag you off. Well, in this case, he was arrested at an airport flying back from Pakistan. Now, that's suspicious. Pakistan. But suspicion, I mean, you know, you've got to have more than just suspicion. If you're going to put somebody in jail for 2.5 years, you can certainly follow them around. You can certainly do investigations. You can see, you know, it's... You notice the, what was it, Stephen Hatfield, the guy that they thought might be the anthrax killer? They certainly harassed the heck out of him. So, I mean, there are other options, right? But, no, in this case, the 2.5 years in jail. If they came by your house, dragged you off, threw you into a jail cell, 23 hours a day, locked down in solitary confinement, can't call anybody, can't send any mail, can't get any mail, nobody can call you, people don't even know where you are, you don't have a lawyer. See, this is the kind of stuff that the British did to us in the 1760s that upset us so much that in the 1770s we said, enough! And in the 1780s, we wrote a constitution that said, these are the things a government shall never do. Well, U.S. District Judge Henry Floyd in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and one of the folks in our chat room, I believe, mentioned, yes, Padilla is the Spanish pronunciation, but he pronounces it Padilla, which is, you know, go figure. Anyhow, one of the folks in the chat room, I'm looking at the chat room here. This is the ongoing discussion. If you want to drop into our chat room, by the way, tomhartman.com will get you there. We'll be there for the next 4 hours, actually. And as one of the folks in the chat room said, that U.S. District Judge Henry Floyd was actually appointed by Bush. Now, this is secondhand information, but the chat room is more often right than wrong. And said the government cannot hold Padilla indefinitely as an enemy combatant, a designation President Bush gave him in 2002. So Bush just comes up with this phrase. Oh, enemy combatant. Now, this is not, you won't find this phrase in the Constitution. And as the judge said, the court finds that the president, that being George W. Bush, has no power, neither expressed nor implied, neither constitutional nor statutory, that means it's not in the Constitution, there's no law been passed, to hold petitioner as an enemy combatant. 23-page opinion was a stern rebuke to the government, according to Associated Press writer Mark Sherman. He gave the administration 45 days to take action. Can you imagine? I mean, if Denise Williams, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in South Carolina, says, if everything you say about Jose Padilla is true, prove it! Everybody says the war on terror could last a lifetime. If they can do it to him, they can do it to you and me, too. If you have evidence, prove it. If you don't, let him go. If you think he's suspicious, follow him around. But, geez, in 2.5 years in custody, certainly you would have gotten enough evidence by now to be able to prosecute this guy in a court of law, or let him go. 29 minutes past the hour.
A party at Ed's house. Okay.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
What do you call a tax cut for the wealthiest 1%?
Homeland Security.
What do you call the other 99 who can't make the rent?
Homeland Security.
A lovely little bit of phraseology for all the neocon men when they announce a massive deficit. Something that they can say to preface it. What do you call the cable guy who's rifling through your mail?
Homeland Security.
What do you call it when you get arrested for clipping a nail?
Homeland Security.
Two little words that mean a shock in our campaign.
And welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our thought for the day from President George Bush, the motto by which he has lived his life.
If it feels good, do it.
And if you got a problem, blame it on somebody else.
Thank you, George. Always good to hear that sort of advice from men of your stature and experience at just that. Speaking of George W. Bush and the Constitution, one of the folks in our chat room reminded us of George W.'s thoughts on the Constitution.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
Well, China is doing something that no U.S. administration has done since Jimmy Carter left office. They're doing it in concert with the beginning of the Kyoto Accords. And I find this absolutely fascinating. The Chinese, and in fact, I think that there's probably going to be significant benefits to the United States as a result of this, because when they make things in China, we tend to buy them. It's just a shame that we're not doing it here. I mean, this was an opportunity for the United States to become a world leader and really, really, really substantially boost our economy. And we blew it. Anyhow, here's the story. This Dateline Beijing, China. This is from Greenpeace's website. Today, the Chinese top legislature voted to pass China's first renewable energy promotion law, which will help the country meet ambitious targets for the uptake of renewable energy. You get this? Jimmy Carter did this. Jimmy Carter looked around and he said, you know, I mean, he'd been a nuclear engineer on a submarine, on a nuclear-powered sub. The guy understood energy when he was in the Navy. And he's got a master's degree in some field of sciences, and he's no dummy. And he looked around and he says, you know, we used to produce all the oil we needed. In fact, we used to export oil to the rest of the world. That's, you know, one of the things that made John Rockefeller rich. And then we kind of dried out the oil fields in Pennsylvania, and the oil fields in New Jersey went dry, and the oil fields in New York went dry, and the oil fields in Ohio went dry, and Standard Oil of Ohio and Pennsylvania Oil Company, now known as Pennzoil, they just became refining companies because they weren't pumping oil anymore. And the oil fields in Michigan, I remember as a kid, there were oil wells in Michigan. There are actually still a couple out there, but few and far between, and they're just pumping the dregs. Indiana, Kentucky, all these states had oil wells in the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century. And now, nada, niet, nothing. And so Jimmy Carter looked around and he said, you know, we have used up our oil before, and we're doing it again. And as our oil supply is diminishing, our need for imported oil is increasing. And we saw what this could produce during the Nixon administration when, during the, I believe it was the Six-Day War, because we supported Israel, the Arab countries, which controlled most of our oil at that time, said, sorry, guys, we're not going to sell you any. I remember that well. It was, as I recall, it was either 72 or 73. Must have been 72. Louise and I were living in Detroit. Louise was pregnant with our oldest daughter. And the Teamsters Union went on strike. I remember there were long, long gas lines. In fact, in Detroit, there were several murders. People would, you know, get in these gas lines and, you know, for hours and hours and hours, and somebody tried to cut in. People shot each other. Murders for gasoline. And the truckers went on strike, and so they weren't shipping food into Detroit. And so all the stores just went, boom, you know, empty, just like that. And it was a scary time. And how did Nixon deal with it? Nixon says, okay, we've got to, you know, we'll go to, okay, even if your license plate ends with an even number, you can get your gas on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And if it ends with an odd number, you can get your gas on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Or something like that. And, you know, it was a disaster. And there was, you know, similar problems. I mean, there was still an echo of it going on when Jimmy Carter came into office. And so Carter said, we need to become energy independent. How are we going to become energy independent? We're going to have to jumpstart an industry. We'll provide some tax incentives to do it. We'll come up with things that will cause this industry to say, gee, this is a good, the people will say, hey, I ought to get into that solar power business. I can get a government grant to do it, make it a little easier. Bring in the entrepreneurs. The people who have great ideas, but they don't have two nickels to rub together. Give them a little scratch. Give them a little seed money. Help them start. And boom, an industry was birthed. And let's create demand for this. Well, how do you create demand for it? Go to the average person and you say, if you build your home in an energy efficient manner, if you make use of these technologies that are being developed by these entrepreneurs that we're encouraging, then we'll give you a discount on the taxes on your home. And people are going, whoa, this is great. And all of a sudden, it's like everybody wants to know which way is solar south. I had never heard of solar south before Jimmy Carter came along. Suddenly, everybody wants to know which way is solar south. So that when you build your house, you can point most of the windows towards solar south, that part of the horizon where the sun is most of the day. The greatest percentage of the day goes from solar, North America, the sun rises in solar in the southeast and then goes to the south at noon and then goes to southwest to set. It only rises in the east and sets in the west on the equator. Maybe very southern Florida gets close to that, but the rest of the country. So where is solar south? Everybody wants to know. And an industry was born. So China looks around and they say, we are concerned about this. China is now competing with the United States for Russian oil. One of the things you can bet was on the discussion between George and Vlad in the castle on the full moon. China is now negotiating with all of these Caspian Sea countries. They're sitting on some substantial reserves of oil. China, of course, is looking for oil themselves. They have a lot of coal. In fact, I remember when I was in Beijing in 1987, the city just had this permanent kind of haze as a result of all the coal fires. The coal was everywhere. But there was not a lot of oil. Oil was in short supply. And so China has said, we've got to do something about this. So the Chinese top legislature voted to pass China's first renewable energy promotion law, which will help the country meet ambitious targets for the uptake of renewable energy. Greenpeace, on their website, they say they welcome China's commitment to clean energy, as a new law could kickstart a massive take-up of clean energy. This must have been written by somebody, Greenpeace UK, such as wind power. With the potential to become the world leader in renewables, China could transform the global markets. I'm telling you, this is such an opportunity. If Dick Cheney was given responsibility, when he became vice president, he was given responsibility for two task forces. They were supposed to meet and come up with recommendations for the president and Congress. The first was the task force on terrorism and homeland security. And that task force, he never got around to. They did not even meet once before 9/11. There were other things that were more important. He had to have his meetings with Ken Lay. There's other things more important. So there was that task force. And then he was in charge of the energy task force. And they get together behind closed doors and they hatch these schemes. They put this stuff together. Hey, what would be a good deal? Nuclear, we'd like a few billion by the oil industry. We'd like a few billion by. And pretty soon, you got $9 billion in welfare for the dirty fossil fuel industry and the nuclear industry. And Cheney comes out and says, okay, here's a plan, guys. Of course, he's keeping secret. He went to the Supreme Court to keep secret from you and I, we the people, who was at those meetings and what they said. But in any case, if they instead had gotten together and said, what's going to be the best thing for America? Not what's going to be the best thing for our campaign donors. Not what's going to be the best thing for the fossil fuel industry. But what's going to be the best thing for the United States of America, for the people of this country? If they had simply asked that question, the obvious answer would be, the best thing for this country would be to be less dependent upon foreign oil so that we don't have to have thousands of our soldiers die and be wounded in foreign lands, particularly the Middle East, for oil. And so that we don't have to continue polluting our air with mercury that comes from the burning of oil and coal And carbon dioxide that can cause greenhouse warming, global warming that could literally lead to the end of life as we know it on this planet. But no, they didn't say that. And if they had, by the way, and if they had gone back to what Jimmy Carter was doing, which came to a screeching halt when Ronald Reagan came into office, his first official act, of course, in office being removing the solar collectors from the roof of the White House that Jimmy Carter had put up there. If they had simply done what Carter was proposing, they could have birthed an industry and we could have become the world's leader. And now China is set to become the world's leader in renewable energy. It's called the Renewable Energy Promotion Law, and it takes effect the 1st of January of next year. So it's just a little down the road, about 9 months down the road. It's going to allow renewable energy industry in China to take off. You betcha. The law guarantees grid access for renewable energy producers. Now, here in the United States, you have energy companies that are fighting to say, no, if somebody's on the grid and they want to feed power back into the grid, don't let them do it. And there are actually communities and states that have passed laws to make it very, very difficult to do that at the behest of industry. Number one, you can feed it back into the grid. The law's enactment is a signal of China's intentions in relation to global climate protection efforts, as well as its commitment to cleaner air and energy security. And it's well-timed with the entry into force of the Kyoto Protocol. At present, China has no binding obligation under Kyoto, but as the world's second largest emitter of CO2, international attention has focused on the country and its efforts to curb CO2 emissions growth. Notes Greenpeace. Remarkable. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. John in New England is on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, hi. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, John?
Great program as always. I wish you were on 24 hours a day.
Well, actually, on White Rose Society, I am.
Oh, yeah, that's right, too.
They have a Tom Hartman channel, and this program repeats itself over and over and over and over and over again, 24/7.
Right. So. You know, Tom, I think of the downtrodden people of Caracas, of Venezuela, the way they stood up against the American installed strong man.
Yeah.
I think about, our friends in the Ukraine that did it and the brave citizens of Lebanon, which are in the process of doing it now.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, what are we as citizens of the United States doing? We're worried about the Academy Awards, Michael Jackson's wardrobe when he goes to court, the impending snowstorm on the East Coast.
Actually, what you're describing, John, are not what we, the citizens of the United States, are worried about. You're describing what the media is talking about.
Right,
there's,
exactly.
There's a difference. There's a huge difference. We, the people, are very concerned about our jobs. We're very concerned about our politics. We showed up in massive numbers to vote in the last elections.
The vote was stolen.
In my opinion. But whether it was or not, the vast majority of Americans, if you actually ask people questions about the issues, do you think Social Security should be privatized? No. Do you think we should have national health care insurance? Yes. Do you think we should have a more aggressive EPA so that we have a clean environment? Yes. I mean, all of these so-called radical positions are actually the radical middle. This is where America is at.
Well, the Congress isn't listening to what we have to say.
No.
They're not.
No.
We've got to take to the streets peacefully. We really have to do, just like we did in 2003, the anti-war demonstrations.
Yeah.
We've got to get out there en masse and at least teach others, the other citizens of our country, what's going on. We're in dire straits, and I think we really deserve exactly what we're going to get if this comes to fruition with this president we have.
Yeah, no, we have to get active. John, I appreciate your call, and I agree with you totally. Mark in St. Petersburg, Florida on the line. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, this is Mark with JustSayNoToFascism.com.
Oh, cool. Great website.
Absolutely, yeah. I have free bumper stickers that say the same thing, and I also wrote the book by the same title. I just want to make a remark that stupidity can kill. When you've got
and is, by the way, Mark. It's the stupidity of this administration is killing Americans. Look, from Vioxx to the mercury in our air to the war in Iraq, the stupidity of these right wingers is killing us.
Certainly. I mean, when you've got them teaching creationism as a science in the schools, you've got them defunding our drug education programs and yet still incarcerating people for it. When you've got media pundits, what they're doing is they're dumbing down our society.
Yeah,
they are creating a lumpen proletariat.
Aggressively, yeah. It's bread and circus. It's the old Roman strategy. Keep them dumb, keep them entertained, just as long as they have enough food. Just enough food, not too much food, just enough food. then
just keep them docile.
There you go. Bread
it's
and bread
extremely
and
dangerous, and we are in a very extremely dangerous spot. I urge everyone to join the ACLU. It's the least we can do.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, Mark, so what are you going to do about it? And I know that you've stopped just say no to fascism.com. You've started doing something about it. And
certainly. We have to talk with these folks who are not yet convinced that we're in dire straits. All these folks that are listening to right-wing radio in the afternoons and being severely misled, we need to engage them in active debate constantly.
Yeah, and information, simply informing them. This is the most important stuff. Mark, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Keep up the good work down there in St. Petersburg. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Truth and common sense in broadcasting. 10 minutes before the hour.
The following phone call was not recorded on February.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile. And everywhere I look, your eyes are fine.
Yes, indeed. One of these days we'll be smiling, my friends. One of these days these right-wing neocons will be out of office. The American people will have regained their sanity. The vast majority of Americans already have their sanity. We will have regained our government. And we'll be able to say, hey, good times are back again. But, yeah, we got to put up with it. Sometimes it's like childbirth, I suppose. You got to put up with a little pain to get to the other side, as it were, metaphorically speaking. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Irv in Nyack, New York on the line. Hey, Irv, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hey, Tom, can I tell you my Social Security idea?
Okay, sure, Arv.
Here's my idea from an old lefty.
Okay.
Eliminate the first $10,000 of payroll taxes. You're aware that 80% of the American people pay more in payroll taxes than income tax.
Yes.
We eliminate the first $10,000.
Right, which would be consistent, by the way, with Thomas Jefferson's writings, the first president to talk about progressive taxation, that no person should have to pay any kind of tax, including sales tax, on the first part of their income, which is necessary to cover their home, their food, their education, their children's medical.
And this is what we do.
Right. Okay. Step one.
That gives the worker a $625 tax break.
Yeah.
We're not including the 6.25% of the employer.
Right.
A working couple gets $1,250. Now you got a tax break that they can use to save or to spend additional money.
Right.
You take the $90,000 cutoff point, eliminate that.
Right, so it becomes a flat tax.
Go to the end.
Yep, it becomes a flat tax, yep.
Well, you go to the end, and everybody begins paying beyond the $90,000.
Yep.
That will put so much money into the economy, it will excite working people across the country getting a $1,250 tax break.
Yeah.
The politician who puts that out.
Irv, I think you're brilliant.
Is the next president of the United States.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely brilliant. And what do you propose now, that $1,200 tax break? You're not suggesting that people should mandatorily put that into some sort of retirement program or something?
No.
So there's no privatization component to your suggestion.
There is no privatization. Right. However, there is, if you have a good savings program, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. You realize, of course, Irv, the problem with your suggestion. The problem with your suggestion is that there are people making over $90,000 a year, making over $1 million a year, making over $5 million a year, making over $10 million a year, making over $100 million, you know, Michael Eisner, you know, making over $100 million a year. And all of a sudden, they're going to have to start paying taxes that they're not paying right now. And
this is the greatest shift of the burden of taxation from the working people to wealth.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be significant. It would be significant. But right now, the wealth is not taxed, and they don't want to be taxed. And that's the fatal flaw, I suspect. Because
well, now, why can't
those
we
who,
put this out there?
Because those who own the media are those who are making all those bucks, sir. I think it's a great idea, and I'll promote it. I salute my hat to you.
You want to get a hold of me?
Well, not right now. But let me put you on hold, and you can talk to Ira. We'll get your contact. Whoops. Get your contact information there. Here, there we go. Yes. You've been listening to True People's Radio here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, telling the truth some multinational corporations would really rather you weren't all that aware of. Bread and circus, that's their agenda.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vasily Nikoraskin. I'm the president and founder.